power. That includes building three times as much offshore wind capacity in 8 years as in the last two decades, the NAO said. We have launched world-leading blueprints, such as our British energy security and net zero strategies, with many plans already implemented to ensure we are on track to achieve our 2050 net zero target. A spokesperson for the Department for Energy Security and Net Zero told Sky, "Even though the targets are ambitious, we haven't taken our foot off the pedal, and our commitment to decarbonize the UK's electricity system by 2035 remains resolute," the spokesperson added. Sky News also noted energy bills may rise again without government plan to deliver 2035 clean power target. NAO warns a missing plan to decarbonize Britain's electricity network is costing households. The report warned the NAO audits prompted calls for government to lift a de facto ban on onshore wind. Household bills could rise if the government further delays its plan to rid the power network of polluting fossil fuels by 2035, the National Audit Office recently warned. Energy officials committed to the target almost 18 months ago, but their plan to deliver it was delayed by the energy crisis, as they focused instead on tackling soaring bills, the auditor said. However, today the NAO warned it was not clear when the new energy and net zero department would come up with a plan to decarbonize the grid, and this delay could drive up household bills even further. The longer it takes before government finalizes its delivery plan, the greater the risk that it won't achieve that ambition to decarbonize power by 2035, or that doing so will cost consumers more, warned Simon Biddlestone, NAO's Director of Value for Money Studies, adding, "Decarbonizing power is really the backbone of achieving net zero, as we are all likely to switch to electric vehicles and potentially use electricity to heat our homes, but it will require a step change investment and modernization. Generating electricity accounts for 13% of Britain's emissions. Some 40% of UK electricity comes from burning fossil gas. Although the country has so far decarbonized faster than any other G7 country, according to government data, demand for electricity is set to soar 60% by 2035 as the economy continues to shift away fossil fuels. Meeting that demand requires an enormous surge in renewable wind and solar power, including by building three times as much offshore wind capacity in 8 years as in the last two decades. Stuart Dossett, senior policy advisor at think tank Green Alliance, said the government should prioritize lifting an effective ban on onshore wind. "Onshore wind is one of the quickest to build and cheapest forms of electricity we have," he told Sky News. "The shortfall in the UK is slowing us down from moving as quickly as we need to move to cut carbon emissions and to bring energy bills down," Dossett added. "Renewables are significantly cheaper than gas, and gas is what is driving up the price of energy. Recent UK prime ministers have changed their minds on onshore wind, and Rishi Sunak's administration is currently running a consultation on relaxing rules. The report detailed how Britain's outdated grid is already costing taxpayers and will only increase without a plan. That's because when power generated from a plant exceeds demand or what the grid can accommodate, energy companies have to limit their output, which costs money that is paid by the consumer," The grid also needs upgrading and expansion so it can transmit power from where it is made, for example, in Scotland, to where it is needed, potentially in Cornwall. The auditors warn the government must make up its mind which technologies will be used to power the UK during cloudy and calm days, including batteries for short-term power, longer duration energy storage like compressed air, hydrogen from renewable and nuclear. Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm David Miller, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In this week's special show, we're examining attacks on Palestine Declassified, and in particular on our regular host, Chris Williamson. As a result, we're doing things a bit differently today. I'm standing in for Chris as presenter, and he's taking my place on the sofa as one of our two guests. It's reported in the tabloid press that a parliamentary committee has taken away Chris's pass to enter the House of Commons as a result of his work on this show. I'll be talking to Chris and to another well-known guest about what lies behind these attacks. That's after a special report by Latifa Abu Shakra.
The Daily Mail attacked the presenter of Palestine Declassified, Chris Williamson, recently reporting that parliamentary authorities are facing calls to consider revoking a security pass held by a former Labour MP, who now fronts a show on Iranian state TV. According to the Mail, he continues to enjoy privileged access to Parliament by holding one of more 300 passes doled out to former MPs. As an historic Freedom of Information victory showed, lobbyists have exploited the system, but the Mail produced no evidence of any such issue with Chris Williamson. Conservative backbencher Henry Smith told Mail Online, privileged access should not be used to give succour to governments that wish us ill. Brendan Clark-Smith, Tory MP for Bassett Law, stated, Westminster doesn't need a mouthpiece for the Iranian regime. Williamson told Mail Online, the willingness of these parliamentarians to make utterly baseless accusations about me, while remaining silent about hundreds of MPs acting as lobbyists for the hostile regime in Tel Aviv, reveals their shameless hypocrisy. But was Williamson correct? Who are the little-known MPs rounded up for a quote by the Mail? The privately adduced Smith has in the past taken trips funded by the preeminent Zionist lobby group in the US, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. And he has been a member of the political council of the hardline Zionist think tank, the Henry Jackson Society. Clark Smith has been an MP only since 2019, and within weeks had attended a Conservative Friends of Israel, CFI, lunch with Zionist regime ambassador Mark Regev. He can be seen obsequiously fawning over Regev in this picture he posted on Facebook. He has also taken part in one of the CFI's infamous propaganda tours to occupied Palestine. But is this all about Palestine? It seems likely these two useful idiots are being wheeled out to push a bigger agenda. Smith is a member of the House of Commons Foreign Affairs Committee. This may be a clue. The newly appointed chair of the committee is a new MP called Alicia Kearns. She has been pushing the idea of proscribing the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps as a terrorist organization. She has also called for the closure of mosques in the UK, alleged to have some connection to the IRGC. Who is Alicia Kearns? Prior to being an MP, she worked in propaganda for the Ministry of Defense, and she ran the Foreign Office's spooky-sounding Counter-Daesh Coalition Communications Cell for 2 years, facilitating the covert UK intervention in Syria. Then she worked at Global Influence, a propaganda firm that was a Foreign Office contractor. All these roles were deleted from her LinkedIn page after she was declared as a candidate in the 2019 election. But despite her obvious connections to MI6, it seems that the Foreign Office is not playing ball, according to a Saudi propaganda channel. Could this be the reason the Mail has run the bizarre story on Chris Williamson?
This week, we are joined as a guest by Chris Williamson. Chris is a former Labour Member of Parliament and Shadow Minister. He was Jeremy Corbyn's most outspoken supporter in Parliament and was one of only a few MPs to use their parliamentary platform to call out the Israeli regime and promote the liberation of Palestine. His book, 10 Years Hard Labour, recounts how the Corbyn leadership lost its way after the early euphoria. And he's been the host of Palestine Declassified for the last 12 months. Our other guest today is Mark Wadsworth. Mark is a veteran black rights campaigner and journalist. Just over 30 years ago, he founded the Anti-Racist Alliance and led the Labour Party Black Sections movement in the 1980s. He campaigned to obtain justice for Stephen Lawrence and catapulted the case onto the international stage when he introduced Stephen's bereaved parents to Nelson Mandela. Mark's book, Comrade Sack, tells the story of the first Asian MP elected to the British Parliament in 1923. Mark is currently active in the Liberation Movement, which is a black grassroots movement dedicated to defeating racism. Welcome to the show. Chris, can I ask you first, how many times have you used your past in Parliament? And more generally, what do you make of this campaign against you?
Well, interestingly, I've actually not used my past at all. In fact, I've not set foot in the House of Commons or the Palace of Westminster since I lost my seat back in 2019. But I think it shows the level of hypocrisy, frankly, and pettiness of the political class in this country at the moment. Because whilst they're targeting me, because I present this programme about the struggle of the Palestinian people here on Press TV, there's not a peep about the support that we see in Parliament for the apartheid regime. I mean, around half of the members of the Parliamentary Labour Party are members of the Labour Friends of Israel. A bigger proportion, actually, of the Conservative Party are in a similar body. Nor is there any criticism of people like Jack Straw and Norman Lamont, who are involved, chair and president of the British Iranian Chamber of Commerce, which has actually seen trade increase in recent times up to £600 million per year. So, you know, they speak with forked tongue, it seems to me.
Sure. Mark, you were famously attacked when you said that MP Ruth Smeath was collaborating with the right-wing press. Do you think that the lobby has an outsized influence in Parliament?
Well, first of all, I observed Ruth Smeath working hand-in-hand with a Daily Telegraph reporter, Kate McCann, went on to work for Sky. The Daily Telegraph, a viciously anti-Labour newspaper and even more viciously anti-Jeremy Corbyn. And I remarked in an aside, really, at the launch of the Chakrabarti report into anti-Semitism and other forms of racial discrimination about what I had seen. The main thrust of what I had to say that day was, look around this room. We're talking about fighting racial discrimination. Where are the African Caribbeans? Where are the Asians? It's as if there was a hierarchy being played out over which prejudices, which hatreds were more important than others and being privileged. Islamophobia was nowhere to be seen in the discussion. Anti-black racism. And when you talk about outside forces, isn't it interesting that that self-same MP who staged a sort of political gig as an ambush to attack me as a Corbyn supporter, albeit a leading black rights campaigner, went on to, after she lost her seat at the election, become the head of Index on Censorship, which is supposed to be policing around the world our rights to free speech. And yet she cancelled me, effectively, with a statement and getting me expelled from the Labour Party and has been rewarded with a seat in the House of Lords after that. And my final point is that Index on Censorship and her have been discredited. The president of Mexico was, according to Index on Censorship, the tyrant of the year last year. This is a left-wing president.
Terrible.
You know, when you think of Trump, when you think of Bolsonaro in Brazil, they're tyrants that should have been outed by that organisation if it had a smidgen of a credibility on the left or, you know, in liberal society.
Thank you, Mark. Chris, the head of Elbit, the Israeli arms firm, was caught on camera in 2012 saying that they used the Conservative Friends of Israel as a piggyback to access decision makers. Can you tell us a bit about the Conservative Friends of Israel and its influence?
Well, I mean, as I was saying in my previous response there, I mean, a huge proportion of Conservative members of Parliament are actually supporters of members of the Conservative Friends of Israel. And it's a, you know, it's a similar picture in the parliamentary Labour Party as well. And certainly, I think it's pretty clear to me, you know, given the unambiguous support that there is for the apartheid regime, I mean, there is literally no criticism. And people in Parliament, that is, and people who do raise their head above the parapet and actually call out the apartheid regime in Israel are actually targeted and attacked as being anti-Semites. So they are very, very influential, it seems to me. And it's a national scandal, in my opinion, that the Fourth Estate, the, you know, the national media, never draw any attention to this fact. Why is it that we have a hostile, you know, foreign state that has such influence in the mother of parliaments? I mean, it is really an international scandal.
Indeed. Chris, I wanted to ask you about this woman, Alicia Kearns, who is this MP, who's the chair of the House of Commons Foreign Affairs Committee. And she had a background working in the Foreign Office, but yet if you look at her LinkedIn profile, it's been scrubbed and it doesn't say anything about that. I wonder, how could she have got into a role in the Foreign Affairs Select Committee as chair so early in her career? Indeed. Do you think that MI6 had a quiet word in those years?
It certainly looks that way, doesn't it? I mean, clearly a favoured daughter. I mean, I didn't serve with her. She came into Parliament in the election that I lost my seat. But we do know that she's a former press officer with the Ministry of Defence, I believe, and I also understand that she was running a regime change propaganda operation on behalf of the Foreign Office in Syria. And let's remember Syria, I mean, half of Syria is being occupied right now by the United States, and the part of Syria which is being occupied, let's remember, are Syria's oil fields and its breadbasket. I mean, then again, you know, this is another, you know, outrage where the corporate media are silent.
Totally silent, yeah. Mark, can you tell us, what do you think? Why is it that the Corbyn project failed?
Well, a big reason, I mean, you can cite Brexit and the fact that they wouldn't accept the democratic vote and wanted to change it. And Britain, British people believe in fair play, that if you lose, you put your hand up and say, I've lost, and get on with it. But also the capitulation to a lobby that Chris has talked about, apologising, appeasing, capitulating, and rather than fighting people who the Labour Party's own Ford report have said weaponised anti-Semitism in a grotesque way. You know, there are legitimate concerns. You know, when swastikas are put on Jewish headstones in cemeteries, when Orthodox Jews are attacked in Stamford Hill in North London by racists, that's anti-Semitism. But what was going on in the Labour Party was cynical. The people on the right wing who were a faction against people like Chris, myself, Jackie Walker, Ken Livingstone, had no interest in fighting genuine anti-Semitism.
That's right. We're going to have to leave it there with the latest attacks on Chris over Palestine and indeed over Ukraine.
The British Iranian Chamber of Commerce is dedicated to endeavour to enhance further bilateral trade, commerce, services and transport links between the UK and Iran. Its chairman is the Right Honourable Jack Straw, who served as a minister throughout the years when Blair and Brown were Prime Minister. He stepped down as an MP in 2015. The President is the Right Honourable Lord Lamont of Lerwick, previously the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Minister of Finance, from 1990 to 1993 in the John Major government as Norman Lamont. Both Straw and Lamont have access to Parliament, Straw through the use of a pass in the same way that Chris Williamson would have access should he choose to go to Parliament. Yet neither of these former MPs are being attacked in the Daily Mail about their relations with Iran. What's going on? The reality is that this is an ideological attack on Chris Williamson and his work in solidarity with Palestine, including directly with Palestine Declassified. It is striking, though, that only one newspaper, the Daily Mail, has attacked Williamson. In its second story on the case, it failed even to get a quote condemning Chris by a named MP, relying instead on an unnamed former government minister. This suggests a division within the British establishment over this question, and that the apparent outrage is entirely confected by a narrow grouping connected to the pro-Israel lobby. We can pick up clues on this by the inclusion of complaints about the tweets on Ukraine. The Mail claimed MPs recently reacted with fury to Mr. Williamson's Twitter post about Mr. Zelensky's speech to Parliament this month. He claimed Mr. Zelensky was backed by literal Nazis and hit out at current Tory and Labour MPs who salivate about escalating the war in Ukraine. One MP, a former government minister, suggested to Mail Online that Mr. Williamson was basically repeating Russian propaganda about the Ukrainian leader, who is Jewish. Here we see the attempt to whitewash actual evidence of Nazism in Ukraine by pleading that it is anti-Semitic because of Zelensky's religious background. This is a line directly from the playbook of the Zionist regime. In the event, Williamson responded, NATO's cheerleaders in Parliament are allied with and arming Nazis in Ukraine who are behind the Kiev regime's 8-year-long bombardment of the Donbas region prior to the Russian special operation. The confected controversy over my parliamentary pass, which are routinely held by all former MPs, is another reminder of the disturbing scale of censorship that pervades British society today. Palestine Declassified will not be deterred by bullying attempts at intimidation. We will continue to report the truth about the occupation of Palestine and the global efforts made by the Zionist movement to shore up their declining power.
Mark, given your long history in anti-racist politics, can you tell us about your view of the role of Palestine in the anti-racist movement?
Palestine has always been central in the thinking and the politics of the anti-racist movement. I remember when I edited the Black Agenda, the groundbreaking Black Agenda in 1988, after four of the Black Section members, Bernie Grant, Paul Boateng, Diane Abbott and Keith Vaz, made history by getting elected to the all-white, previously all-white parliament, that we had a section on Palestine. And so it's always been a part of our thinking. They're people of colour in the global south, fighting for their liberation and against settler colonialism. And so in that sense, it's been central to our thinking and our declarations of solidarity with our sisters and brothers in Palestine.
Chris, when you made those comments about Ukraine, I mean, we saw Zelensky arrive in Parliament and there was this obsequious standing ovation and a huge cheer went up. It's true, isn't it, that almost every MP in Parliament now is absolutely in favour of war with Russia?
Absolutely. I mean, it was a nauseating spectacle, actually. I mean, and frankly, had I been in Parliament, I can assure you that I would not have been in Westminster Hall for that occasion and would have made my feelings known to the media. But you're absolutely right. And what troubles me is that there are no voices, no parliamentary voices now speaking out for peace, speaking out for diplomacy. I mean, whatever you think about this conflict in Ukraine, whether you think Russia was right or wrong, surely somebody in Parliament, you would think, would be arguing for peace, because nobody can win from war. And we even have now the absurd spectacle of you know, bastions of the so-called left in Parliament, the Socialist Campaign Group, people like John McDonnell, who is fully on board with sending more arms to Ukraine. Indeed, he says sending arms to Ukraine is a pathway to peace. It is utterly absurd.
Amazing. Mark, when you made those comments about Ruth Smith, the Zionist MP, quite innocent comments, did you wouldn't have known, presumably, that WikiLeaks had said in one of their leaked State Department files that she was referred to as a State Department asset, strictly protect. What do you make of that, that someone like Ruth Smith was actually effectively an asset of the US government?
Absolutely appalled. And if you think in another state, she would be up for possibly treason. It's not something that you expect, that someone with that background would be in Parliament, much less on the Labour benches. And this outfit that she's gone to, on probably double the wages she was on in Parliament, is funded by the Americans, same as other enterprises she's been involved in. So she has a bit of a track record.
Yeah, absolutely. Chris, can you tell us more about the Socialist Campaign Group? I mean, it's not really a socialist group, is it? And it doesn't seem to have been able to defend any of its members who have been criticised.
Well, no, indeed. I mean, it was established originally by Tony Benn, who lost patience with the old Tribune Group, which was the former kind of bastion of the left in Parliament. And, you know, Tony set up something which he hoped would genuinely, you know, campaign for a socialist programme. But unfortunately, all of the members of the Socialist Campaign Group today really seem incredibly timid and unwilling to actually, you know, speak out on important issues of the day. And, you know, a key example of that, for example, was a fairly modest statement, I've got to say, that was prepared by the Stop the War Coalition, criticising the war in Ukraine. And, you know, it was even-handed. It was as critical of Russia's actions as it was of NATO's, and was calling for diplomacy. And I think about a dozen members of the campaign group put their name to it. Starmer then insisted that they must remove their names on pain of losing the whip, I think. And every single one of them, not one of them, was prepared to stand by their principles. And what it indicates to me is that they are all careerists. They put their career, in inverted commas, as a parliamentarian, the nice salary and cushy pension rights, etc. They put that above all else. They put that above any principle.
Mark, your history with the anti-racist movement is a long and exalted one. I mean, you've been through the Anti-Racist Alliance, you've been through the Black Sections. Where are we at now with the anti-racist movement in the UK?
I think that the anti-racist movement globally is in good shape, thanks to Black Lives Matter first time round, 2012, and then being resurrected after the murder of George Floyd in the United States a couple of years ago. And you saw those protests on the streets, protests day after day, organised on TikTok, yeah, Instagram, social media, in a way that we couldn't have dreamt of, Chris.
No.
You know, going back, you know, with the miners, mm-hmm, 83, 84, other struggles that we've had. This shows a militancy and an energy that is also reflected in the environmentalist resistance of Extinction Rebellion, Occupy, Just Stop Oil. And it has had a dramatic effect, because if you look at the way that politics has been greened, people are talking, the Labour Party, the Green New Deal, they're talking about zero, what's it called, emissions or whatever, getting rid of fossil fuels. And the same is happening with anti-racism. Not fast enough, but I think that the struggle is outside of Capitol Hill in America, outside of Parliament in Britain. Insurrection is the name of politics today. What's happening in France in the fight against the pensions being imposed by that right-wing Macron president?
Thank you, Mark. Great. Chris, I've got a question for you, which is about your book. It's about this MP. Is it really true that Lynn Brown MP called for a fund to be raised to assassinate you?
Yes, indeed, it is true, actually, yeah. Not only that, when she was challenged about it, she said that she wanted to murder me in the most painful way possible. It's an indication, really, that clearly I was ruffling a few feathers, I think, when I was in Parliament. I was Jeremy Corbyn's loudest champion. I was leading a campaign to democratise the party because I believe you had a real opportunity to bring about a transformation in this country, and not just in terms of domestic policy as well. What we were talking about was a socialist domestic programme and an anti-imperialist international policy. I think that's what frightened the horses more than anything. And what really inspired me about what I thought we were on the process of, or on the cusp of bringing about, was this anti-imperialist government. A government that was a permanent member of the UN Security Council, that had a minister for peace and disarmament. And I hope that one day Britain, under a Labour government led by Jeremy Corbyn, would be a government that would be promoting peace and disarmament around the world rather than war and arms sales, which is where we are right now. And I'm afraid both parties in Parliament are signed up to that. Both parties are in support of the war machine and imperialist foreign policy.
Thanks, Chris. Well, I'm afraid we're out of time again today. Thanks to our guests, Mark Wadsworth, and our special guest, Chris Williamson. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So, until next time, this is David Miller saying bye for now.
Congratulations to everyone on 15th of Sha'ban. We here at Arabi English Radio congratulate all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of 15th of Sha'ban, the birth anniversary of the 12th Imam, Al-Qa'im al-Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance. Congratulations to all our Muslim listeners on this most auspicious occasion.
In the limelight.
Crackdown on dissidents and activists have increased considerably in Saudi Arabia since Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman took power in the country. The Saudi kingdom has sentenced human rights activists to decades imprisonment for posting tweets critical of the Saudi government. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has reported on this story and gives us more details. American public relations firm Edelman has signed deals worth $9.6 million with the Saudi kingdom in the past 4 years to sanitize the image of the kingdom, especially in the United States. Citing the U.S. Department of Justice documents made available by the watchdog group Open Secrets, The Guardian reported on Thursday, 22nd of December, since Jamal Khashoggi's murder, the powerful public relations firm has received or is contracted to receive $9.6 million in fees from the Saudi government agencies and companies controlled by the Saudi regime. The report adds, most of Edelman's work for the Saudi regime has focused on rehabilitating its reputation in the United States, an effort that the kingdom had begun before Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi was murdered by Saudi agents in Istanbul, Turkey. This comes just 2 weeks after a U.S. court dismissed a lawsuit against Saudi Arabia's crown prince and de facto ruler, Mohammed bin Salman, over his role in the 2018 murder of Jamal Khashoggi, after Washington decided to provide him with legal immunity in the case. Khashoggi, who was murdered and dismembered by a Saudi hit squad at the Saudi consulate building in Istanbul in October of 2018, used to be a vocal critic of the kingdom and its crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. Edelman's services to Saudi Arabia come as its CEO, Richard Edelman, has on several occasions claimed to support human rights and oppose repressive regimes. The report reads Edelman is not the only American firm doing business with the Saudi regime. The firm's work for the regime is particularly notable given its reputation for producing the Trust Barometer, an annual survey of public trust in government, business and media and other institutions. During this year's gathering of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, Edelman published a special report of the Trust Barometer, focused on geopolitics. The company said that 59% of survey respondents agreed that punishing countries that violate human rights and international law is a business responsibility. The chief executive officer of Edelman, Richard Edelman, stressed then that 59% of respondents said Businesses should get out of countries with repressive governments. Edelman has not responded to a question on whether it is ready to stop its lucrative deals with Saudi Arabia. Human rights groups have long voiced concern over the grim situation of human rights in Saudi Arabia, as any form of criticism against the government is cracked down harshly. The Middle East Monitor has also covered the same story. Freedom House named Saudi Arabia as one of the worst nations for human rights and civil and political liberties violations. Michael Abramowitz, the president of Freedom House, said the Saudi government really restricts almost all political rights and civil liberties and engages in arbitrary imprisonment, torture, execution of perceived opponents. Freedom House added, "It's really a pretty grim picture." Sarah Leah Whitson, the executive director of Democracy for the Arab World Now, said under the Crown Prince's rule, power has become much more concentrated than ever before in Saudi Arabia. Sarah Leah Whitson added, "Any criticism of the government, any criticism of the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is met with extreme repression." However, over the same period, the picture represented by the Saudi government to influential American audiences has purportedly been brightened with the help of key contractors, including the public relations firm Edelman. The documents Edelman filed make it difficult to confirm exactly how much it had been paid by the Saudi government, and the company did not respond to requests to provide an exact figure. In February of 2020, Edelman registered as a foreign agent representing the Saudi Basic Industries Corporation, a chemicals manufacturer that is majority owned by the Saudi government, to promote the Business 20 gathering of executives, which took place in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. The work, which was directed at American audiences and was projected to net Edelman more than $5.6 million in fees, included sending regular press releases that celebrated topics such as mainstreaming women in business and doubling down efforts to empower women and youth. One release featured a quote from Princess Rima bint Bandar Al Saud, the Saudi ambassador to the United States, who commanded the B20 Saudi Arabia's deep commitment to the empowerment of women, including an inclusive policy development process that she hoped would remain as one of the Saudi presidency's lasting legacies. The Saudi regime continues to imprison women's rights activists, sometimes sentencing them to decades imprisonment for simply posting tweets critical of the Saudi government. The 21stCenturyChronicle.com website has also covered the same story. Sarah Leah Whitson, the executive director of Democracy for the Arab World Now, said NEOM's development has been accompanied by the mass displacement of the local indigenous population, adding, "Anyone who protests or questions this approach has faced imprisonment and even death." In October, less than 2 months after Edelman's latest contract was signed, a Saudi court sentenced 3 indigenous people to execution for refusing to be evicted from NEOM construction. On 31st of May this year, only days before Edelman published his blogspot warning of the growing divide between democracy and autocracy, he signed a $79,000 contract to provide the Saudi Ministry of Culture with public relations and communication services. According to the New York Times, the ministry is led by Prince Badr bin Abdullah bin Muhammad bin Farhan Al Saud, who is a close friend of the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Edelman's work for the ministry included a promise to research identity and monitor online conversations and media coverage to identify friends and detractors, mainly in the US media. The Saudi government has a record of targeting, harassing and pursuing its critics abroad, including in the United States. Edelman is far from the only U.S. professional services firm doing business with the Saudi government. McKinsey & Company, Boston Consulting Group, Hogan Lovells and Corvis Communications are all among the many other U.S. companies doing business with Saudi Arabia. But Edelman's work for the regime is particularly notable, given its reputation for producing the Trust Barometer, an annual survey of public trust in government, business, the media, and other institutions.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the geopolitical situation in West Asia with strategic analyst Sharmeen Narwani. But first, this brief analysis.
The world is experiencing fundamental changes in the global power constellation. And as the geostrategically most important region in the world, West Asia is in the middle of these historic transformations. Like other regions in the world, it's experiencing major economic problems related to inflation and the combined aftereffects of the global COVID pandemic, U.S. mismanagement of the global economy, and more than 20 years of a devastating global war by the U.S. in the name of the so-called War on Terror. The world is only now coming to understand the profound significance of the historic defeat that the US and its allies experienced in West Asia in the early 21st century, in Iraq, in Syria, and in Afghanistan, which some have suggested was a third world war by historic standards, and which effectively ended any claims of the US to global hegemony and began a reordering of global affairs by the victors. But who were the winners of this Third World War? The Islamic Republic of Iran, with its allies in the various resistance movements of the region, joined later by a resurgent Russia and a rising China, who are all now in the process of creating a new global order with its own institutions, independent of the West, for the first time in centuries. This is turning out to be a big test for many local elites in West Asia, who have staked their continued worldly power and existence on US and Western backing. And we are already witnessing their desperate efforts to quickly reorient themselves towards these new powers in order to save their illegitimate tribal and military dictatorships. What's clear to most observers is that West Asia will be very different at the end of the year 2023 than it is at the beginning of the year 2023.
Sharmeen Narwani, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. You are the editor-in-chief and columnist of the Cradle online magazine, which deals with, which focuses on the geopolitics of West Asia, and you recently launched the Arabic language edition. I'm very happy that we're able to do this conversation. I follow your publication, and there are a lot of excellent analysis and articles and news items in there. Always, a good place for people to go to if they want to know what's going on in West Asia. And so we're going to take this opportunity in this conversation to look at a more broad analysis of, make a more broad analysis of what's happening in West Asia. There's a lot of interesting things happening. Reports about this idea that this is going to be you know, transformative in ways that, you know, historic, very significant strategically. So if you could give us a little bit more on that in terms of, you know, this area, West Asia, becoming, going back to what it was historically, this center of global trade, this center of global, you know, cooperation between East, West, North and South.
Yeah, you know, this comes from, I mean, by the way, what you were mentioning about Iran and Russia and the route, this also heavily includes India.
That's right.
So, you know, and India post the Ukraine war has very openly warmed up to the Russians.
Right.
And put their foot down with the Americans on sanctions against Russia, on sanctions against Russian oil and gas, and said, no, this is not in our interest. We're going to move ahead. But importantly, the Iranians, Russians, and the Indians are leading this route initiative called the International North-South Transportation Corridor. And this drew the attention recently, I think it was Bloomberg or the Wall Street Journal, that said the Iranians and the Russians have created a sanctions-busting route in which, you know, through which they can trade. But in fact, INSTEC has been around and in development for a long time. They conveniently left out that India is a major leader and driver of this project. And now you have, you know, direct capital-to-capital transportation route between these three countries. And these are all connecting. So it's not just China's BRI project, but there are a lot of players in the region, from Turkey to Azerbaijan to Iran to Russia to, you know, who are Pakistan and China, CPAC, you know,
right,
who are creating these corridors that have been in development for a long time. We actually did an article, published an article by the former Austrian foreign minister, who is an oil and gas expert and a longtime diplomat, and really understands these transportation routes in a way that I don't think many European leaders do.
Right.
I mean, she said all routes, all pipelines are heading east. She said this a long time ago, and we're now seeing this. But she wrote about a route in the north of Russia because of global warming and melting of icebergs.
Right.
We now have the ability to circumvent all the main routes of European powers, you know, to get goods and transport goods between continents, can now be circumvented very quickly and cheaply. So this is, you know, I've argued that we've been in World War III mm-hmm. since Syria. And
right.
Why do I say that? Really, there's no hysteria intended behind
right.
this language.
Right.
If you look at the world wars, there mm-hmm. are several things that are absolutely part and parcel of a world war. One is a major power standoff. In
That's
a
right.
sense, the Cold War was a world war. We just don't categorize it as
right.
that.
Because
okay?
they didn't have a war between themselves, but the rest of the world was in war, in a situation of war, proxy
yes,
war.
It was a major power standoff. But importantly,
right.
how do you characterize one kind of war as a world war and another not?
That's right.
Importantly, after a world war, you have a rejigging of global institutions.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay?
Yes.
And that's important. In Syria, we saw the BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and then South Africa as a later entrant, produce a joint communique on foreign policy for the first time, which was in 2012.
Right.
And it was on Syria. Okay. So, you know, we saw during this process a movement of, now it's being sped up, Russia and China and Iran, and others looking at alternative ways to message between banking systems.
That's right.
And to create alternative currencies and, you know, that are gold-backed or backed by a basket of currencies.
That's right.
All these things started then. We're only hearing about them now because, you know, the global war has advanced. The world war has advanced.
Would you also agree that also because the fact that the media, the global media is so dominated by Western media, at that time when these things were happening, at the time when the U.S. and all its allies with all their money and all their, you know, military might were losing the war in Syria and lost the war in Syria to Iran, to Russia, to the resistance, to the Syrian army, that, you know, it was kind of not mentioned. It's like okay, this thing, major thing happened, there are these things happening, but well, let's not talk about it because it's not beneficial to, you know, the empire that's, that media is serving.
Yeah, that's for sure. But I have to say, even resistance media does not do geopolitics very well. They don't know how to analyze. They don't have, they don't do propaganda well. And when I say propaganda, I'm not talking about like videos overlaid with music showing battle scenes, okay? That's really bad propaganda. I mean, when I use propaganda in a positive sense, in that a government or a group is describing their value proposition to the masses, okay? So good propaganda would be for the Iranian people to understand what the Iranian government was doing in Syria, not be questioning it years later. You know, I could have explained to the Iranian people what the what the Iranians were doing in Syria, that it was existentially important, that it was to stop terror. I mean, we could have explained this from year one.
That's right.
You know, but still in year nine, many Iranians will ask, you know, why are we spending money in Syria? And I have to explain the concept of strategic depth. You know, America considers the entire world its strategic depth.
Exactly.
Most countries consider their bordering states their strategic depth. And it doesn't mean, strategic depth doesn't mean colonizing or, you know, being an imperial power or forcing yourself on neighboring countries. It basically means establishing, you know, solid enough relations that the neighboring country will never be used as a launching pad against you.
Exactly.
So this is why Iran can no longer rely on its borders. It has to have Iraq and Iraqi authorities secure the border from the Iraqi side. Do you understand? And it has to have Syria secure the border with Iraq, so you don't have this free flow of Salafi, Takfiri types into Iran.
Exactly.
Okay? So this is why Iran needed to be in Syria, because these Takfiris would only be heading eastward.
That's right.
Okay?
And the same on the eastern border with Afghanistan.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is like a no-brainer. I mean, why were the Russians and Chinese in Syria? Now, many people will argue that the Chinese were not, in fact, an ally of Syria. I absolutely disagree, and I'll tell you why. First of all, they used a very important tool from time to time, which was the Security Council veto. They didn't always let Russia do it on their own, but that is a major play.
That's right.
At the Security Council, okay? The Russians didn't need to be on the ground for much of this conflict because Syria's Iranian allies, okay, and Hezbollah allies and various other militia allies were on the ground, okay? The Chinese didn't need to be in the air in Syria because the Russians took that role.
Exactly.
China had their back all the way because they understood fully. I mean, we know the propaganda about the Uyghur situation in China, for instance.
Right.
They understand fully that there are elements that would like to take that Western province away from China, stir up conflict there, make terrorism a daily thing in China. And the Russians understand in Dagestan, Chechnya, whatever, that the same target is there. So these countries were also fighting existential battles in Syria. Hence why I call it the first battlefield of World War III.
That's right.
Okay.
Very
it's
nice.
It's now moved to the Ukraine. Okay. But it's been in various theaters. Some will not require major powers to be involved. Like, for instance, in Venezuela, but the Russians are there, the Iranians are there, and of course the Chinese are making great efforts to do business with all of Latin America, which the Americans cannot countenance because it's their backyard forever.
Right, exactly. Well, that's very interesting. I mean, I think you make a good case that we really did witness what at any other time in history would have been called a world war, and that, as you said, there's a new order being shaped after that.
Yeah.
That it's both institutionally, but also in terms of the balance of power that exists between the different powers that are there, and you know, it seems to me that we sometimes underplay the role that Iran had in this story. And of course, sitting in Tehran, I have to make the case for Iran's significance in this. As we saw, Iran was in Syria for 3 years before the Russians came. So, as you mentioned, there was this understanding, this strategic understanding that happened at the highest level of the leadership in Iran. And of course, we had General Qasem Soleimani, you know, taking charge of what was going on. And of course, Martyr General Hamadani, who was the main commander at that time, the Iranian commander that was there. And I just want to suggest something to you, you know, maybe based on what you were saying, that, you know, this lack of understanding of strategic depth. And, you know, I've done a lot of research in this particular question, and it seems to me it's a historic problem that, you know, we were taught not to think strategically. And it was something that the only people who are allowed to think strategically were the Americans or the British. Of course, you know, maybe those of us like me and you who were able to get educated in that part of the world, that was part of our training, part of how we were taught to think strategically. But it seems to me that there's this idea that, you know, strategic thinking is something for others to do and, you know, not something that Iranians or people in West Asia should do. As you mentioned, it's even something within the resistance media and the people who are in favor of the resistance who have a very low understanding of these strategic affairs. If you could maybe talk about this idea that this might be actually a historic problem.
Well, I mean, I would have to disagree with you from the onset of that argument because Iran and chess, you know, Iran, the Iranians are viewed as stellar strategic players. There is nobody who would argue otherwise. I just think that is not translated to the general population.
Right.
The Iranian government does not propagate its value propositions and its, you know, its goals and its pathways to realize these goals very well.
So in other words,
maybe because they don't understand media. Okay?
Well,
and let me
understand what you're saying. So you're saying that on a strategic level, whether it's the leadership or governments, they actually do it very well.
Yeah.
They actually have that strategic understanding.
They do it very well. But when I come to Iran, I struggle to see who's making these decisions because I'm not meeting
them.
Well,
that's part of our trick is nobody's supposed to know who's making the decision.
And
but what you're saying is that this is not translated into a more general understanding, whether it's in the education system, whether it's in the media, that would then allow normal people in Iran who are not involved in these decisions to understand what's going on, contrary to maybe some other countries.
I mean, someone who does it well in this region is Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah. He's on, you know, he's on television frequently, and you can hear a pin drop in Lebanon, you know, even in the homes of his opponents when he's speaking, because he makes the effort to describe what is going on and what Hezbollah's goal is in what is going on and the fact that they will not participate in what's going on and this is why, or we will participate in what's going on and this is why and this is how. Now, Iran is a nation, you know, it doesn't need to do that every day, whereas Hezbollah is, you know, represents a portion of Lebanese society, right? So Iran and the Russians and Chinese, you could all say, are masters of strategic ambiguity. You know, what shocks me is how often the Americans thought, from Obama onwards, you know, and still think that they can temper Iran's behaviors by engaging with them in some kind of way. Iran does what it does because it's beneficial to Iran.
Right.
Period. Every country should act in that way. You don't sell out something that is beneficial to your country in order to make a deal somewhere else. You make a deal over something that is, you know, expendable, but not something that is fundamentally, you know, important to food security, national security, water security, things like that. So the Americans plod on. I mean, during the Syrian war, I mean, countless newspaper articles year after year on, like, will Putin drop Assad? You know, Will Khamenei drop Assad? And so this is an important game. This is an important tactic that Moscow, Beijing, and Tehran frequently use.
Right.
But I will say that Iran does not do a sufficient job in explaining its value propositions, its strategic imperatives to the Iranian people. Khamenei does it, but not everyone listens to Khamenei. You do have large, maybe, large numbers of Iranians.